Welcome to 30 Minutes of VOA Learning English, the voice of America's information service for people learning English. Join us now for the Education Report and the Making of a Nation, coming up after As It Is.
Hello and welcome to another program designed to help you learn and improve your American English. I'm Jim Tedder in Washington. Today we are concerned with your health. We have information about a disease that seems to have spread from Africa and Asia into the Western Hemisphere. If you have mosquitoes near your home, you will need to listen carefully. Then, imagine you are sitting outside near the end of another day. Every now and then you see something fly above your house very quickly and make sharp turns. No, it is not a bird. It is a bat, and it too may be a serious disease carrier. What are these illnesses, and how can you protect yourself from them? We'll have the answers next on As It Is. A painful disease found mainly in Africa and Asia has been discovered in the Western Hemisphere. The World Health Organization reported last December that two cases of chikungunya were found in the French part of the Caribbean island of St. Martin. Since then, the disease has been reported on other islands in the Caribbean. Chikungunya results from a virus. It is passed to humans from the bite of an insect, the mosquito. The disease can cause a higher-than-normal body temperature and pain in the head. It also causes pain in the joints, which can last for weeks. Chikungunya rarely kills people, but there is no treatment or vaccine for the disease. The WHO says chikungunya infected many people in the African nation of Gabon, in India, and islands in the Indian Ocean about 10 years ago. It spread within Europe for the first time in 2007. Peter Hotez is the head of the National School of Tropical Medicine at the Baylor College of Medicine in Texas. He says he soon expects to see reports of chikungunya in the southern United States.
The mosquitoes are here. That's an important factor. Second, there may be some component of global warming.
He says insects carrying the disease are found in places where poverty and development are increasing, such as in the southern United States. Straw-colored fruit bats are found across much of Africa. The bats carry two deadly viruses that could spread to people. While scientists have long known this, they did not know until recently how many of the animals were carriers. A new study has found that one-third of the fruit bats are infected with a virus similar to the one responsible for the viral disease rabies, and 42% carry henopaviruses, which can cause a deadly disease. The new study was a project of researchers with the University of Cambridge and the Zoological Society of London. The researchers studied blood and tissue from more than 2,000 bats from 12 African countries. They found the animals were genetically similar, meaning they travel and live together across the continent. James Wood of the University of Cambridge says this genetic similarity helps speed the spread of the viruses. Fruit bats live in groups of more than 100,000. These groups often live near cities. In some areas, people hunt the animals for their meat. Eating bat meat can spread the viruses to humans. henepaviruses can also be spread through contact with waste products from bats. Neither disease has been reported in humans in Africa, but experts are warning that could change. Allison Peel helped to prepare a report on the study. She warns that trying to remove bats from cities could increase the risk of infection. In her words, the most appropriate response is ongoing studies and public awareness to avoid handling bats, and to wash the wound thoroughly if you are bitten by a bat. The report appeared in the journal Nature Communications. In December, China reported the death of a woman who it said was the first human to become infected with a new kind of avian influenza virus. Researchers are working to learn more about the H10N8 strain of the virus that killed her. The World Health Organization says the speed at which China reported the case shows the country is getting better at identifying deadly viruses. The 73-year-old woman died late last year, just 6 days after visiting a poultry market in Jiangxi province. Bernhard Schwartlander is the WHO's representative in China. He says the quick identification of the bird flu that killed the woman shows the increased strength of China's surveillance system.
The fact that the Chinese authorities have detected this case in this 73-year-old woman who had other medical conditions actually shows that the active surveillance system, the active alertness, is working quite well.
The woman often visited markets where live chickens and other poultry were sold. She was taken to a hospital on November 30th and died December 6th. She had suffered from high blood pressure and heart disease, which may have kept her body from being able to fight the infection. Dr. Schwartlander says officials need to watch other people closely to see if the disease has spread.
Of course, we are always concerned when we see that the virus actually jumps the barrier from one species to another. And we have to be very careful watching this, because every time such a thing happens, it has, of course, in theory, the potential for wider spread.
Last year, about 100 people were infected with the H7N9 strain of bird flu. Chinese officials reacted quickly with increased testing and reporting of similar cases. The H10N8 virus had earlier been found in Guangdong province and lived in poultry for many years. Dr. Schwartlander says the first human death from the virus is a worrisome development.
This is the first case that we detected the virus in a human being.
In 2002 and 2003, some countries criticized China for being slow to release news about severe acute respiratory syndrome, also known as SARS. The disease killed more than 700 people. As health officials followed the disease, the government told reporters in China not to report on SARS. Government officials also did not tell WHO researchers much about the spread of the disease. Since then, China's health systems have improved, but some experts say China must work harder to study laboratory-confirmed infections. Chinese officials are also closely watching for cases of the H5N1 bird flu virus, which has killed more than 380 people since 2003. Scientists fear the virus could change and then spread quickly from one person to another. When it comes to your health, it is always better to know than not to know. There are more Learning English programs coming your way next. And world news at the beginning of the hour on VOA. I'm Jim Tedder in Washington. The Education Report is next, followed by The Making of a Nation. You can read and listen to our programs and download MP3s at learningenglish.voanews.com. You can learn with us on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at VOA Learning English.
From VOA Learning English, this is the Education Report. Sahanoon Mahamud has never lived in Somalia. But the 21-year-old student has helped establish an organization that supports aid projects for the East African country. Sahanoon Mahamud is a co-founder and director of a group called Students for Somalia. He is following the humanitarian example of his mother. Mr. Mahamud attends William and Mary College in Williamsburg, Virginia. It is a long way from Somalia. However, that coastal nation is home to many of his relatives. His parents were born there. His mother, Filsan Darman, helped start the non-profit agency Adimaga Somalia. It provided for aid to Somalia in 1987. Filsan Darman said the agency provided food and clothing to Somali people. They had fled to the Somali capital Mogadishu to escape violence in the north. Sahanoon Mahamud praised his mother's service.
She's been helping Somalia since before I was born.
Mr. Mahamud became involved in humanitarian projects early in life. One of his goals for starting Students for Somalia was to get more non-Somalis to take part in helping Somalia. He noted that many Somali aid organizations have only Somali members.
So my group and my whole motto has been, let's let every ethnicity and race help Somalia. And I think it's a huge resource to have non-Somali people helping Somalia.
This year, Students for Somalia and Adamiga are cooperating on a project to fight poverty and increase education. Mr. Mahamud said the groups loan money to women who have lived a long time in refugee camps in Mogadishu. They use the money to start or support businesses like small food stores. The women must have a child in school in Somalia to receive the money. The loans are small, from $100 to $500. The woman must keep her child in school as a loan condition. She also must pay back the loan, but Mr. Mahamud says the woman does not return the loan money to the lender. Instead, she gives it to her child's school. That way, he says, the school can make improvements.
So it's really about education and keeping kids in school.
Mr. Mahamud says Students for Somalia centers its efforts on education. He says education provides a long-lasting solution to most of the country's problems. He says young people will not have to leave school to work if their mother's businesses are successful. He also believes it will help prevent them from becoming child soldiers for armed groups. And that's the VOA Learning English Education Report. I'm Christopher Cruz.
VOA Learning English. Welcome to The Making of a Nation, our weekly program of American history for people learning English. I'm Steve Ember. This week in our series, we talk about the election of 1828. It was bitter and full of angry words and accusations. The old Republican Party of Thomas Jefferson had split into two opposing groups. President John Quincy Adams led one of the groups. It called itself the National Republican Party. Andrew Jackson, a military hero and politician, led the other group. It called itself the Democratic Party. Each party had its own newspapers. In Washington, the Daily National Journal supported President Adams. The United States Telegraph supported General Jackson. The Telegraph published accusations by Democrats in Congress against the administration. The Journal, in turn, published a pamphlet that said Jackson had fought a man, chased him away like a dog, and then stolen his wife. Jackson denied these claims. Historians still do not know how much of this story is true, but the story had a great effect on Jackson for the rest of his life. Jackson met the young woman, Rachel, at her mother's home near Nashville, Tennessee. Rachel and her husband, Louis Robards, were living there at the time. They were having marriage problems. Robards argued with his wife about Jackson. He said she and Jackson seemed too close. Robards reportedly wanted to fight Jackson with his fists. Jackson said he would face Robards not in a fist fight, but in a gunfight if Robards wished to fight like a gentleman. Robards rejected the invitation to a duel, and nothing more happened between the two men. Robards and his wife settled their differences, but a short time later, they had another dispute, and Rachel left. Court records said she left with a man, Andrew Jackson. Rachel's family said she told Robards she wanted a divorce. They said he threatened her, telling her he would carry her away by force. So Rachel's family said she decided to flee. She decided to go with some traders to Natchez in the dangerous Mississippi Territory. By now, Rachel meant a great deal to Andrew Jackson. He had fallen in love with her. When the traders asked him to go with them to Natchez to protect them, he agreed. The group left for the territory early in 1791. For his part, Louis Robards began preparations for a divorce. He allowed Rachel's family to believe that he and Rachel were no longer married. But in fact, he did not complete the necessary legal action to make the divorce final. Jackson returned from Natchez after several months. His opponents later claimed that he had married Rachel while in Natchez. They said she was still another man's wife at the time. Opponents said the couple's relationship was both immoral and illegal. They said Jackson was an adulterer for having a relationship with a married woman. And they said Rachel was a bigamist for having two husbands. But Jackson said he believed Rachel and her first husband, Louis Robards, were divorced. He said he returned to Nashville to ask Rachel's mother for permission to marry her daughter and that she agreed. Andrew and Rachel Jackson remained in Tennessee. The next 2 years were busy for Jackson. As a young lawyer, he worked hard and traveled far. Then in December 1793, Jackson said he discovered court papers showing that Louis Robards had only recently divorced Rachel. Jackson said he was shocked. As soon as possible, he and Rachel were married again, legally this time. Almost 10 years passed. Jackson became a judge and got involved in Tennessee politics. But the circumstances of his marriage remained an issue that led to arguments. For instance, a man once accused Jackson of cheating on a horse racing bet. Then the man called his wife a bigamist. Jackson killed the man in a duel. Later, in the 1828 presidential election, Jackson's opponents made Rachel's honor a campaign issue. Jackson could not duel everyone who questioned his wife's honor, so he asked a special committee of citizens to investigate his marriage and make a public report. Many people on the committee were his friends or supporters. The committee found that the Jacksons were not at fault for getting married before Rachel and her first husband were legally divorced. The pro-Jackson newspaper in Washington published the committee's report. Pro-Jackson papers also began to print vicious stories about President Adams and his wife. Anti-Jackson newspapers did not publish the committee's report. They continued to denounce the Jacksons' marriage. Historian Daniel Feller at the University of Tennessee is an expert on Andrew Jackson. He says the charges about Jackson's marriage made a good story for people to talk about. But, he says, other accusations were more serious. These were about Jackson's career.
The attacks that really hit home were about Jackson's unauthorized and perhaps directly against orders conquest of Florida in 1819, his sometimes savage disciplinary measures against his own troops, his declaring martial law in New Orleans and maintaining martial law in New Orleans and arresting people in New Orleans well after the War of 1812 was actually over.
All during the bitter election campaign, neither Jackson nor his opponent, President Adams, said anything about one very important issue, slavery. Adams did not want to lose what little support he had in the South and West by denouncing slavery. Jackson did not want to lose the support of some Republicans in the North by openly defending it. Adams's silence did not mean that he approved of slavery. Southerners were sure that he opposed it, and Jackson did not have to tell the South what he thought about slavery. He was a slave owner, and he had bought and sold slaves all his life. There was another important difference between the two men and their political parties. President Adams and the Republicans represented the interests of those who owned property. Many of the president's supporters felt that wealthy, property-owning citizens should control the government. Jackson and the Democrats represented the interests of the common people. They did not feel that the rich had more right to govern than the poor. The presidential election of 1828 was held on different days in the different states between October 31st and November 5th. Voters in the northern states supported John Quincy Adams. Andrew Jackson won the South. Historian Daniel Feller says Southerners did not seem bothered by opponents' fears that Jackson was mentally unstable and believed he should have unlimited power.
They were much more compelled by the image of this great man of the people and also this great man on horseback, the hero of New Orleans.
Even President Adams recognized that Jackson was extremely well-liked.
John Quincy Adams wrote in his diary years before the election that in a popularity contest, in a political contest, no man could stand against the hero of New Orleans.
When the electoral votes were counted, Andrew Jackson received 178. President Adams received only 83. Rachel Jackson was proud of her husband, but she was not happy about the life she would have to lead as First Lady, and her health seemed to be suffering. For Mr. Jackson's sake, she said, I am glad. For my own part, I never wished it. Nevertheless, the couple prepared to move to Washington. There was little time for Rachel to rest. Then, just a few days before the Jacksons were to move, two doctors were called to the Jackson home. They found Rachel in great pain. She seemed to be having a heart attack. After a day or so, she appeared to be better. She was able to sit up and talk with friends, but her mind was still troubled about the years ahead in Washington. I had rather be a doorkeeper in the house of God, she said, than to dwell in that palace in Washington. She was referring to the presidential mansion, later known as the White House. In December of 1828, a few nights before Christmas, Rachel was sitting in a chair. Her husband had already gone to sleep. Suddenly, Rachel cried out and fell to the floor. The servants screamed. Jackson ran to the room, picked Rachel up, and carried her to the bed. But he could see that life had already left her. Witnesses said Jackson continued to sit next to her, holding his head in his hands. Rachel was buried 2 days later. 10,000 people went to the funeral. The Reverend William Hume spoke of Rachel Jackson's life. He talked of her kindness and humility, and he told how she had been upset about the personal accusations against her during the election campaign. Jackson believed those accusations were a cause of Rachel's death. His anger is expressed on the stone above Rachel's grave. One line of the inscription says, "A being so gentle and so virtuous, slander might wound, but could not dishonor." At that time, Andrew Jackson was 61 years old. He was a tall, thin man. His long face was wrinkled. Most portraits of him show a great mass of messy hair pushed back from his high forehead. Jackson's health had never really been good. He carried in his body two bullets from duels fought years before. But he was a tough man, with a spirit strong enough to keep moving, even when he was grieving. He left for Washington in January 1829. A huge crowd was gathering there to meet him. They would create one of the wildest inaugural celebrations in American history. And that will be our story next week. I'm Steve Ember, inviting you to join us next time for The Making of a Nation, American History from VOA Learning English.